Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Juravich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. If you have ever had a hard time picking out what book to read next, we have a suggestion for you. Actually, 3,599 suggestions to be exact. Columbus native Dan Pelzer passed away in July and left behind over 100 pages of handwritten book titles, all of which he read during his lifetime. He began his list in 1962 when he was in the Peace Corps in Nepal, and his last entry was in 2023. He also leaves behind a family that is dedicated to sharing his love for books with the rest of the community, and since his list went viral, they are now sharing it with the world. Joining us now is Marcy Pelzer, daughter of Dan Pelzer, and one of the creators of the website What Dan Read. Welcome to All Sides, Marcy.
Thanks, Amy. It's so nice to be here today.
So I'm very sorry about the loss of your dad, but what a legacy he left behind for you. When did you first know your dad had this reading list? When did it catch your family's attention?
About 20 years ago, I was asking him what he was reading, and he pulled the list out of his bedroom. I'd never seen it before. And what a remarkable document. Realized that he had been keeping it since 1962.
So you saw the document 20 years ago, and then you're like, oh, okay, that's a great list. But then when he passed away, what made you decide you wanted to share it with others instead of just keeping it in the family?
I knew it was a very special thing that kind of it kind of tells the story of his life, and that our close family and friends would love to have a copy. So the original idea was just to print it and have copies at the funeral that people could take home. But I had never realized that it was more than 100 pages and that wasn't feasible. So a family friend, my godson, actually pulled together a quick website and we published it that way and put a QR code on the funeral programs, thinking that would be the end of it.
Yeah. And did Dan know about these plans that you planned to maybe like share his list after he passed?
Absolutely not. It was his personal reading list. He was always happy to share it. But he actually, as his health sort of declined, he stopped reading. And when he passed, we didn't even know where the list was. We found it in a box in my brother's basement in Worthington. So definitely there were not plans to do anything with the list except to keep it as a memento.
Yeah. Okay. So you made this QR code. You're like, we're going to get all fancy. We're going to use technology instead of actually photocopying the list. When did you first realize that it kind of started to go viral? Did you hear from someone who you're like, how did you know about that?
Well, before it went viral, I work in communications, and I started thinking over the weekend before I went back to work that, wow, my colleagues would probably be interested in this too. So I put it on LinkedIn. And when I put it on LinkedIn, I thought, he was a really great lifelong patron of the library in Columbus, the Columbus Metropolitan Library, and I should probably let them know too. So I just went on the online forum, figured out how to email Lauren Hagen, the CEO, and said, hey, wanted to share that I put this book list on LinkedIn. I tagged you. It was my dad's list. He was a great patron. Just wanted you to know. And within 24 hours, they had started posting about it. And the phenomenon had begun.
Yes. And What Dan Read has been featured in numerous, all over the internet. Lots mm-hmm. of different news organizations have mm-hmm. covered it. It's been all over the world. What do you think your dad would think to know that so many people were just, it melted the hearts of a lot of people? What do you think your dad would think of that?
Well, as soon as first we'd have to explain to him what it meant to blow up on TikTok.
Yeah.
And once he grasped that, I think he'd be really touched and happy. and excited to have the conversation. You know, I wish he could have been having this conversation about books with people around the world who are so interested in every entry. I had my mentee came over this morning. She's an MBA student. And she said, I saw that he read Don Quixote and that made me so happy. And, you know, everybody that reads the list has a different angle, a different hook that they're interested in.
So this list has all sorts of genres and topics of books. It's not like he just read one type of book. Did he ever talk with you, with family, about what he was reading, or did he truly like to read a little bit of everything?
Oh, he definitely read a little bit of everything. He read Sophocles and Homer and Plato, and then he read more than 20 Sue Grafton, John Grisham, and Robert Ludlum books. Mm. There was no rhyme or reason. He read the highest of the highbrow, all of the great books, all of the modern library top 100 books, and then, you know, diet books, Suze Orman, wine books, dog books, mm-hmm. you name it.
Can you remember, like, when you look at the list and look at the years and the dates, can you remember things going on in your family life and if the book was connected? Like, was he reading a how-to parenting book when you were 2 years old or something like that?
Not that. Like, we noticed when we were toddlers that those were the years he was reading the least. Mm. And
wonder why.
Yeah. Another reporter noticed that he was, reading a lot of books about troubled youth in the early 80s. And we hope that the reason for that was he was working as a social worker at TECO with juvenile delinquents. I think the reporter was sort of asking what was going on in our life. But, you know, he read a lot of books for work and was really interested in psychology because he was a social worker.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Fascinating Ohio. We are talking about What Dan Read, a website and now a viral sensation. It's a list of 3,599 books, and we're talking with Dan's daughter, Marcy Pelzer. Was he involved in any book clubs in Columbus? Or was it just him and his books?
He was involved in Bible study book groups over the years. I think he was in a book group at the Reynoldsburg Library after he retired for a little while. And I believe it's possible that he was involved in a book club at the Villas of St. Therese where he lived. I will say that he was vicariously involved in many book groups. So when I was in a book group, I would give him the list every year and he would put all of those on his to read list. And I think he got a lot of recommendations from people who were in book groups.
Hmm. Now, I know that he had a great relationship with the Columbus Metropolitan Library. WOSU even did an interview with a librarian who knew him very well. But did he sometimes buy the books? So he left you this list behind. Did he also leave you a giant library?
He did not. Hmm. And he did not like to get books as gifts. He wanted to check books out. I have one beautiful leather volume that he left behind that was a Edgar Allan Poe volume that I think he inherited that I would love to have restored. But that's really the only book we have left from him besides the book that contains all his book list.
I guess a 100-page book list is a book in and of itself, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did he like, the actual book out of the library? Did he ever use an e-reader or listen to audiobooks?
He did not, but I don't think he would have been against audiobooks. You know, a lot of people ask why, part of the reason he stopped reading in 2023 is because his eyes weren't doing well. He also had trouble hearing. So he would have been open to, I think, the technology and other ways of reading. But, you know, just because of his age and, how used to checking books out and paper volumes he was, that he just went with it.
Do you feel compelled, like you need to read all the books on the list, or is that, I mean, that's a lot of books.
I don't feel compelled to read all of the books on the list, but certainly when people bring up books that they find on the list that they found were special to them, I'm definitely going back and reading things I saw on the list, and definitely discovering new books, because I never looked so closely at the list until after he died. You know, he'd mm-hmm. show it to us when we were talking about books, but you know, I never sat down and studied it until he died. So learning all kinds of new things about his interests and what he was doing at different times in his life.
And the list is partially handwritten, partially typed. Is that right? I was flipping through.
Correct.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is it just how he decided to keep track of things or where he happened to be at the moment? Do you know, do you know anything about the way he kept the list?
Well, it's funny because not only is it half, you know, partly handwritten and partly typed, but he's such a thrifty guy that a lot of the pages are on the back of other things that are life milestones. So in the early years, he wrote on the worksheets for learning the language when he was in Nepal in the Peace Corps. And then when he worked at TECO, we saw purchase orders or letterhead. And then, you know, kind of took my breath away when I found in the 90s, one of the pages is on the back of a surgery intake form. So wonder what, you know, he was a cancer survivor. My mom was a cancer survivor. So you wonder if he was, you know, passing the time in the waiting room or actually in a hospital bed reading at that time. So as far as the typing and writing goes, you know, it's when he had access to a typewriter and when he didn't, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know that you didn't expect this to go viral, right? I mean, you just wanted to let the library know. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you didn't expect mm-hmm. what happened, but how has that been for your family? Are you handling it okay? Because being a viral sensation can be overwhelming.
people have been so kind and so loving. And, you know, to have someone on TikTok say Dan is the new America's sweetheart, or to have people in their 20s who are really connecting with the list saying he was the OG book influencer. We love that and it warms our heart. And, you know, my brother and I, sometimes we have a little bit of a snarky sense of humor. So people who make mean comments saying it wasn't that many books or he wasn't really that well written, that just makes us laugh too. So we love all the comments and it's only brought joy.
When I scheduled this interview with you, it was a couple of weeks ago. We had to schedule in advance. And so I thought all the viralness would have maybe died down a little by then, but it mm-hmm. hasn't. Are you? Mm-hmm. I guess one of the reasons it hasn't died down is you were featured on CBS with Steve Hartman, who everyone just mm-hmm. loves. What was mm-hmm. that experience like on the road with Steve?
Oh, it was great to see how the show happens behind the scenes. To be connected with all of the other stories that Steve does that inspire people. And one of the coolest things about what he does is that those stories are part of a curriculum about kindness that is shared with school kids. So that's really meaningful to my brother and me, for sure.
Yeah, that story was lovely. Our listeners should definitely go find it. Mm-hmm. And you wrote me a bio for yourself, and you wrote that you are a Milwaukee transplant, but Columbus will always be home. And you even have a book connection written in it. You used to have an after-school job shelving books at the Columbus Metropolitan Library in the 1980s. So this love of libraries, it extends beyond your dad?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we owe everything that's happened with this story going viral to the geniuses at the Columbus Metropolitan Library and all of the researchers behind the scenes that put the list, went through the list book by book to put it online and, you know, create this system where you can go on their website and find the book with one click and check it out. So we were already lifelong fans, but lifelong super fans now.
Yeah. Columbus Metropolitan Library has a pretty great social media following, mm-hmm. too. It extends beyond your dad, but this one was definitely, mm-hmm. they hit it out of the park mm-hmm. with this one, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, just as a final question, is there anything you would like people to remember about your dad besides what Dan read? I just wanted to give you a chance to, you know, tell us one other thing about him besides the books.
Absolutely. He cared deeply for other people. He had a life of social justice and, you know, simple pleasures and helping people out. His motto was, "I am my brother's keeper." And that's something I think a lot about now that he's gone. And I think that's what he would want the lasting message of his life to be.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And I am sorry for the loss of your dad, but I'm so happy we have what Dan read. We've been talking with Marcy Pelzer, daughter of Dan Pelzer. She took her dad's reading list and turned it into a viral sensation called What Dan Read. Marcy, thank you so much for telling me about your dad today.
Thank you, Amy. It's been a pleasure.
And coming up, we are going to hear from a former flight attendant in the 1960s who decided she'd rather fly the plane than serve the drinks. That's when Fascinating Ohio continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
It's rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Joanne Prater was working as a flight attendant for American Airlines in the 1960s when a pilot gave her the chance to sit in the cockpit and observe. That up-close view convinced her that flying the plane looked a lot more fun than serving drinks to passengers. She no longer flies, but she spent decades promoting aviation to young girls and women through the 99s, an organization inspiring women pilots since 1929. And it was first led by Amelia Earhart, and 99 refers to the number of pilots who started the group. Welcome to All Sides, Joanne.
Thank you.
So I mentioned in the introduction that sitting in the cockpit made you realize that flying a plane could be fun. Can you take us back to that time? What was it like being in a plane? Like, what led you to want to become a flight attendant?
I was watching the pilot and first officer work the instruments and talk to air traffic control. I had earphones on, and obviously I didn't understand that conversation at all. Air traffic control is the one that you speak to constantly when you're trying to, you know, move your plane along. And it seemed so serene up there. I enjoyed being up there. I'm so glad I got to do it.
So from that first time you were invited into the cockpit to the time when you actually became a pilot, I mean, how long did it take you to, you know, get enough flying hours, get the practice, learn how to do it?
I got it in 69, and it was at Lunken Airfield in Cincinnati, on the east side of Cincinnati. I think it took me about 12 hours to get my pilot's license.
And your husband helped you get airborne for the first time. What role did he play in that?
Yes, he did.
What did he do?
We were at a function where they were offering for $5 a flight around that part of Cincinnati, and he bought me that ticket. And that started that right off. And we've talked to the guy that was selling the ticket, and he was the instructor. So 12 hours later, I got my private license.
And the rest is history. So your husband was like, "I'm going to buy you this ticket, have some fun." And then
biggest mistake.
Can you describe what it's like to fly? I mean, I've flown in a plane in the back, but I've never been up there in the cockpit. What is it like to be at the front?
First off, you're in charge of everything. It's a great feeling. It's serene up there. It's quiet, unless you're talking to air traffic control. So all you hear is the engine and the beauty of looking down on the earth while you're up there is stunning. It's always a thrill.
Flying is an expensive hobby. There are costs to rent a plane, there are instructor fees. So when you were learning to fly, you had young children. How did you juggle it all?
It was difficult. I had 2 children in grade school And one day my husband was at work and the children were in grade school and my youngest was not. And I had to arrange flying time with my instructor. So I asked him if I could bring my youngest with me. So he agreed and she pretty much fell asleep once we took off.
That's what I was going to say. You just put her in the back of the plane and you're precisely. Like, yeah, just stay still. Don't touch anything. So part of your work, I mentioned that you are with the chapter of the 99s. This is the Scioto Valley chapter, is promoting flying and aviation for young girls and women. How do you do that? How do you promote aviation to girls and women?
Well, we often show up at various functions. For instance, we just worked at Rickenbacker when they had the air show. Mm. And we have a table with all of the information. And we take turns manning the table and hope that young girls and women come up to ask us about the possibility. We offer, as the local chapter, we offer membership help. Mm-hmm. And also there's an Amelia Earhart scholarship that will pay for all of your flying time to get your pilot's license. We have quite a few young women that show up. Some of them are still in elementary school, but you can tell with they're looking at the brochures and it's just not a casual look. It's like, I think I could do this.
What I guess I don't know this. You have to be 16 to drive a car. How old do you have to be to drive a plane?
That's it.
16? Yeah. All right. Yeah. All right. So I have to imagine whenever you started flying, there weren't very many women in the business.
Actually, there were.
Were? Yeah.
Yeah,
okay.
There were.
So what about today? Do you know much more? Yeah.
Yes, much more.
Okay.
Yes. In fact, the women in my local group are amazing, the accomplishments that they had. One of them is an instructor, and another one is an examiner. Mm-hmm. There are young women that are hoping to be in the military once they get their commercial license, and so they're aiming high, and that's great. We need more young women. Mm. Us old folks are dying off. We need young people.
Tell me what it is like to be a part of the 99s. I mean, tell me about that group and what it means to you.
I think I love the fact that aviation is connected to women getting involved in flying and that we can introduce young people to the possibility. The fact that I can watch them go on to do many more things than I was ever able to do. That's thrilling.
Yeah. What did you do with your pilot's license?
I had very few hours. By the time I moved from Cincinnati to Columbus, I was involved with children in school and various other possibilities, and so I had let it lapse.
So flying for you was, you know, something that you accomplished and you wanted to do, but it was more of a hobby for fun.
Correct. Okay. Yes.
This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about women in aviation with retired pilot Joanne Prater. So one of the things you oversee for your chapter of the 99s is the painting of the compass rose on runways at local airports. I had not heard about this. Can you tell me, like, first of all, what it is and why the compass rose needs to be there?
The last one we painted was at Licking County Airport, which is Heath and Newark. Mm-hmm. And it was in June that we painted it. It's a 70-foot diameter that's shaped like a rose. That's why they call it a compass rose. It's actually 360-degree points. The north point is magnetic north. And so as a pilot, you put your plane in that position and set the compass in your airplane to that particular reading before you take off. Mm. And so the compass rose not only looks pretty in the blue and white from the air, but it's also useful on the ground for pilots that want to set their compass before they take off.
How many of these have you helped paint?
This is probably, down through the years, probably 6 or 8. Mm-hmm. We're hoping to do another one sometime in the fall. The possibility of doing one maybe at WOSU Airport, Don Scott.
Oh, at OSU Airport, yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is an activity, I'm guessing, that you can try to get like the young, wannabe future pilots involved in. Do they help you paint them?
They do. Yeah. They do. They, in fact, some of the members bring their little ones and they help you paint. It takes probably 6 hours if you have a crew of, let's say, 8 or 10 people. We also get the husbands involved and promise them beer if they help us out.
So how often would a compass rose need to be repainted? Do they wear away?
They don't wear away, but the magnetic north setting moves. We probably haven't repainted this one at Licking County. I think we painted many years ago when the airport decides to resurface the area. Then, of course, your compass rose is gone because they, you know, turn black. Mm. So then you have to do, you know, a redo. But that's the only one I think that we've repainted recently.
What do you mean when you say magnetic north moves?
Magnetic north is the setting at that particular airport where you set that compass point in your airplane. You're aiming your nose at magnetic north, and it's reading, and you set it in your cockpit before you take off.
Mm. Now, the 99s were started in 1929, so and there's chapters, I'm guessing, all over the country.
All over the world.
All over the world.
Yes.
Okay. So is the goal of every chapter of the 99s is to increase the number of females involved in aviation?
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes.
What other work do you do besides the compass roses and talking to young kids?
That's pretty much it.
And Amelia Earhart plays a role in this. So Amelia Earhart may be the most famous woman pilot in the world. She set aviation records. She vanished on the final leg of her around the world trip in 1937. Do you know how she ended up getting involved in the 99s?
I think the women back in 1929 wanted to be recognized as proper aviators, aviatrix, I guess they called themselves. So they banded together to start an organization where they could be taken seriously.
And a pilot whose story that you find inspiring, even more so than Amelia Earhart, is Columbus Half's wife, Jerry Mock.
Yes.
So she was the first woman to fly solo around the world in 1964. Tell me about Jerry Mock.
She was an amazing woman with so few flying hours. And the backing she had was nothing to compare to what Amelia Earhart had. But she did it anyhow, and she was persistent about doing it. And even though people said, this is probably not a good idea, she was persistent. And I think it's amazing that she went ahead with it. And
so she flew a Cessna that was christened the Spirit of Columbus.
Right.
What do you find inspiring about that journey?
I guess she finished it.
That would be the goal, right?
Yeah.
I guess that's one thing Amelia Earhart didn't do that final time, right?
Correct.
So her plane hangs in the National Air and Space Museum. I mean, have you been to see it?
Yes.
Yeah, what's that like?
Yes. That's a terrific place to visit. It's magical, yes. I wish more women were featured, but, you know, we're working on it.
Do you see, whenever you go see something like the National Air and Space Museum, do you see planes that are like the ones you flew a long time ago?
Yes.
Yeah. When is the last time that you flew? So has it been a long time?
Yes, it has. Probably last flight I took was somewhere maybe 1974 out of Bolden Field.
What did it mean to you, though, to be able to accomplish that? Because you said you were busy. You were busy with kids. You couldn't afford a babysitter and also be able to do the flying lessons. You had to bring a kid with you from time to time. But what did it mean to you to make the accomplishment to actually get that license?
I think if you set a goal like this for yourself, the fact that you completed it is the best feeling. It's probably the best thing I did for myself. Mm. The goal that I reached. Even though I didn't persist with any more instructions, it was the most wonderful feeling in the world when I finally got that license.
Have you talked to anyone that maybe has talked to you and you've convinced them to give flying a try?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I have.
tell me that. How did you inspire them?
I think telling them that. At the age I was, it's possible to do this. You don't have to be young. You can do this when you're older. Mm-hmm. And just getting your license to fly it's amazing. And the thrill of being up there, trying to describe the feeling of being in charge while you're up there by yourself.
So if there's a young girl listening right now, or even an old girl listening right now, what would you tell her about the idea of getting a pilot's license?
Just set a goal to accomplish this. It's another moment in your life that you may not ever have another chance. And so do it now.
Well, I want to thank you so much for your time today. Thank you for telling us your story. We've been speaking with Joanne Prater, a retired pilot who spent decades promoting aviation to young girls and women through the 99s, an organization inspiring women pilots since 1929. Thank you for joining us today, Joanne.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And coming up, we're going to talk with the head curator of the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News. You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. What started as reading comic strips in a local daily newspaper became receiving a master's degree in museum studies and becoming the head curator at the Ohio State Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum. Jenny Robb has been working with the Billy Ireland Museum since 2005, and she joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Jenny.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
So growing up, you used to read comic strips in the Cincinnati Inquirer. Did it really snowball into this career you have, or did you used to have something else in mind for yourself?
I never thought about studying cartoons or curating cartoons when I was reading those comics, but I knew I loved them. I read them every day. And we were also fortunate in Cincinnati to have an editorial cartoonist named Jim Borgman. Fantastic political satire. And so in high school, I started reading his cartoons, and I just became interested in cartoons in general. But it wasn't really until I was an undergrad at Wittenberg University in Springfield, Ohio, that I had the idea to actually study cartoons as a primary historical source. And that was when I was doing an honors thesis. I was studying modern European history.
Oh.
And I thought it would be interesting to look at how working class women in Victorian England were portrayed in media, particularly the pop culture. But this was before the internet, really. It was the very early days of the internet, so not a lot of materials had been digitized. So I came here to Ohio State University and to the libraries, and I found a magazine called Punch. And it was a humor magazine that featured cartoons that depicted working class women. And so it was there that I started to discover how cartoons can reflect a culture and a society, and we can really use them to investigate what people's lives were like, what was going on at the time, what people laughed at. And it was such an interesting project that I decided to pursue it in graduate school.
Yeah. In the list of careers on Career Day, you know, studying comic strips probably wasn't on that list.
It was not there at all. And I think my parents thought I was going to be, you know, living in their basement for...
So whenever you were writing that paper and you decided to investigate comics and like kind of make this, you know, your dissertation or your thesis, did you think it could become a full-time career?
I did. And the reason that I thought that is that I discovered the predecessor to the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum. So I knew that there was a massive collection of cartoons and comics here at Ohio State, and that collection had a curator. Her name was Lucy Shelton Caswell, and I ended up doing an internship with her when I was a graduate student. And I, you know, came to Columbus and studied with her for about 4 months. I did a number of projects, and I thought, you know, this is the job that I want. Someday I want to have this job, and here I am with that job today.
Wow. What's your favorite thing about working at the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum?
Wow. My favorite thing, I have to say, is getting to meet cartoonists. It's just a wonderful part of the job. So we work with a lot of cartoonists who come and do programming for us. We work with cartoonists who are donating their papers or their art. And so I've gotten to spend time with, you know, some of my heroes, like Jim Borgman I mentioned, but people like Kathy Geiswhite, who did the comic strip Kathy, Art Spiegelman, who did Mouse, Matt Groening. You know, it's just been wonderful to be able to meet folks like that and many, many other amazing cartoonists who aren't household names. So I think that's maybe one of the most exciting things. But I also really love the idea that I'm helping to preserve these important historical documents and artistic works for the future. So that they will be here in 100 years or 500 years or maybe even 1,000 years. And I'd love to be part of that history.
How did Ohio State become this repository for, you know, comics and cartoon work?
Well, it really goes back to the 1920s. There was a cartoonist at the Columbus Dispatch named Billy Ireland, who, of course, is our namesake. And in 1925, a freshman student came and asked him for a job. He needed money to be able to go to school. Many people can understand that. And he liked a cartoon. So he asked Billy Ireland for a job. And Billy said, "Go home and draw me something that'll make me jump out of my chair." And so
not challenging. Okay.
Exactly. So the student came back the next day with a charming comic strip about a first year student who, you know, comes to Ohio State but needs to earn money. And in the comic strip, he says, you know, "Now it's up to you, Billy Ireland." And then in the last panel, it says, "Jump, Billy, jump." And it's a picture, a caricature of Billy Ireland jumping out of his chair, sitting at his drawing board.
So he took it literally.
He took it literally. Yeah. And that got him the job. And that student's name was Milton Caniff, and he went on to become one of the most famous comic strip creators of the 20th century. He did strips called Terry and the Pirates and Steve Canyon. He was basically a household name because everybody then read newspaper comics. So in the 1970s, he contacted his alma mater and offered his papers and his artwork. And the journalism school actually accepted the collection, and that's what started the idea of collecting comics. At the time, not many academic institutions were really interested in collecting comics and cartoons. They weren't taken very seriously. And so Ohio State was one of the first. We were one of the pioneers. And as I mentioned, Lucy Shelton Caswell, she was the founding curator. It was really her idea to create the Center for the Study of Cartoons and Comics here at Ohio State. And now we've grown into the world's largest collection. Yeah.
So it's a library and a museum. Normally, those two things are separate. So tell me how it became both.
We're actually a library, a museum, and an archive. So,
you're three different things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, you know, we started out basically serving researchers, some who are coming from around the world, by providing these historical documents to them. But then we also started collecting original art. So not a lot of museums were collecting original cartoon art. And so we saw a gap there. So with that, you know, we started a museum collection. But also we're an archive, meaning we collect the papers and you know, the correspondence of cartoonists. And then, of course, there are all the books related to cartoons and comics, including comic books. So now we have tens of thousands of published materials related to cartoons and comics.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and this is Fascinating Ohio. And we're talking with the head curator of the Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum, Jenny Robb. There are two exhibits currently being showcased at the museum. The first one I wanted to start with is Motion Lines, How Cartoonists Draw Movement. And this is interesting because at first I was like, oh, you know, a comic strip doesn't need to move. But I guess it does help to show action, movement lines. Tell me about the idea for this and curating this exhibit.
So the idea was, you know, we have this vast collection of original comics. We have over 300,000 original cartoons, and a lot of them, you know, don't get seen and don't get mm-hmm. used. And we thought, well, what's a theme that we could, you know, look at? And the idea being that we want to explain something about how comics and cartoons are created. One of the things about still cartoons is that if you want to show motion, you have to figure out how to depict that with lines on paper, basically. Mm-hmm. It's very different than animation. So our curators of that show are my colleague Ann Drozd and Ben Toll, and they did a fantastic job of looking at all the different ways that cartoonists have solved that problem. And I think it turned out to be a fantastic exhibition.
All right, we'll have to have people come see it, so because we can't describe, you know, movement lines on the radio very well.
That's right, unfortunately.
So, and that is still, it's open now for a few more months, right?
It's open now till November 9th, and mm-hmm. we're open every day except Monday from 1 to 5. Mm-hmm. And the museum is free, so anyone can come anytime.
I was just going to ask that, yeah. So you're open every afternoon, and mm-hmm. it's completely free. You can see, I've been there a couple of times to see different exhibits. So you can see exhibits and, but how did you, how are you able to maintain the free part?
That's a great question. So
you do wonder that every day.
We do, you know, get financial support. We're part of the Ohio State University mm-hmm. Libraries. So we get financial support from the university and the libraries. We also have many wonderful donors mm-hmm. who have made it possible for us to keep this service free. It's also free to come and do research in our reading room if you want to access any of the materials that we have. We sort of operate as a rare books library or a special collection, which means you can't check anything out, you can't take anything away, but anybody is free to make an appointment and come to our reading room and use the materials. So we are really grateful to our donors who help make this possible.
Do you get people who are like you in the past, or that they're looking at your job and saying, I want that someday, and they're coming to do research, so they come and spend several days in your reading room?
Yes, we have people who spend several weeks, even several months in our reading room. You know, again, we are getting people from all over the world because of the rarity of the materials that we have. And we do have people who are interested in curating eventually. And I'm glad to say that more and more universities are collecting comics and cartoon art, and more museums are starting to collect and exhibit comics and cartoon art. So I think that's a great victory for the vision. Lucy Caswell's original vision for the library is that we're helping people see how important this work is as an art form, but also as historical artifacts.
How much have you digitized as opposed to people being able to come and sit down and actually touch the original comic?
Yeah, we've only digitized a tiny fraction mm-hmm. of what's in the collection. Mm-hmm. You know, there are literally millions of cartoons in different formats, whether the original drawing or the actual printed version. And, you know, we've only digitized a small fraction of that. We have a database online that people can go and search what we have digitized. Mm-hmm. But I would say it's unfortunately a tiny fraction. So we're hoping maybe in the future we'll be able to do a lot more digitization.
Is that a goal, or are you a purist and you want to keep it on the paper? I mean, you can be both, I guess.
I think both.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people want to access something and they don't need to see the original or touch the original. Mm. You know, they're looking at the content. And other people are studying and want to see the lines on the page. They want to see the pencil marks that the artist made, the whiteout that the artist may have used to correct something, you know, the things they may have written on the margins of the original. So it really just depends what your interest is in this work, whether you know, can use a digitized version or you really want to come and engage with the actual object. Obviously, most of what we show in the exhibitions are the actual objects.
Right. The other exhibit you have going on right now that I wanted to talk about is called Write It Down, Draw It Out, The Comics of Carol Tyler. So who's Carol Tyler?
So Carol Tyler is an amazing cartoonist who's lived in Cincinnati, Ohio for quite a long time. She was part of the underground comics movement, but she has been doing these amazing books that are memoir comics or memoir graphic novels that are telling her story. She's told the story of her father, who was in World War II, was a soldier in World War II, and how that experience impacted him and their family. So she's just an amazing cartoonist, and this exhibit is quite immersive and is interesting from a design perspective. So I highly recommend people come and check it out, and also check out Carol Tyler's work. Mm. She will be a special guest at an event we're having soon. It's called Cartoon Crossroads Columbus, and it's a 4-day comics festival that we partner with many other organizations to help host. We're looking forward to having her here for that.
Cartoon Crossroads Columbus. So a 4-day event. I mean, do you have other people coming in for that too, besides Carol?
Yes, there are a number of special guests, ranging from Ray Billingsley, who draws the comic strip Curtis, which is in the Dispatch. Jonan Vasquez, who's the creator of the animated show Invader Zim. Mm. And Pulitzer Prize winning editorial cartoonist Dan Telnius. There's also a new track of manga cartoonist. So manga is just Japanese comics. Mm-hmm. The Billy Ireland has the largest collection of Japanese manga outside of Japan. And Cartoon Crossroads Columbus has partnered with an organization to bring some manga artist or mangaka, as they're called, to be guests, special guests at Cartoon Crossroads Columbus.
Yeah, I was going to ask you if when you think of a library, museum, and archive, you think of all old stuff. But you're continuously adding to your collection, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and that's one of the main parts of my job is to think about what do we need to be adding now from contemporary artists that people may want to study now, but may also want to study in the future. And so we're constantly bringing in new materials. Our goal really is to document the entire history of comics and cartoon art. Mm. And so that's still thriving and it's still going strong. And so we do have to think a lot about, what are we collecting now that researchers in the future will be able to use. Mm.
Are you collecting graphic novels then too?
We do. We have
because there's so many more of them now.
So many more of them. There was a time in this job when I could say, "Well, I've read pretty much all the graphic novels out there." No more. There's so many. It's wonderful to see some genres really exploding. Middle grade graphic novels is a good example, and I'll just mention that one of the most important artists in that field is Raina Telgemeier. Mm. We did an exhibition of her work, and she'll be back here on November 8th giving a talk about the catalog that we're publishing with Scholastic that came out of that exhibition that we did. Mm-hmm. So if people are interested in Raina Telgemeier, tickets are on sale. She'll be here on November 8th.
Oh, she's one of my daughter's favorites. I'm happy to know she's coming back.
Yeah, she's fantastic.
Because she sold out when you were here before.
She did. Yeah. She did. We're in a bigger theater this time.
Okay, good. So when you get to that idea of how do you know what to collect, I mean, my son is obsessed with Dog Man and Cat Kid Comic Club and all of those. I mean, do you, I can't think of his name,
Dave Pilkey.
Do you go to Dave Pilkey and you call him and say, "Hey, can we have some of your original papers? We need them for our archive."
That's exactly how it happens.
Okay.
And sometimes cartoonists call us and they say, "Hey, I'm trying to decide what to do with my archive. Are you interested?" And so, we it can work both ways. Mm-hmm. We would eventually like to have all professional cartoonists and comics creators represented in the collection. We can't collect everyone's entire body of work, but that is a goal. We don't currently have any Dave Pilkey originals, but we did borrow one from him for an exhibition at one point. So I hope in the future we will have a good example of his.
Have you ever created any comic strips or cartoons yourself?
No.
Like, I knew you were going to ask me.
I have not. I'm laughing because my husband and my son and I, a few years ago, decided to play Pictionary, and I attempted to draw Ratatouille. Oh. And my son said, "This is just a potato with legs, stick figure legs." with a chef's hat. I did put a chef hat on it, but clearly that is not my area. So I'm not a cartoonist myself.
Does your son like your job?
He does like my job.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a cool job.
He loves to come to the events that we have. He draws himself. And so it's, yeah, I think he thinks what I do is pretty cool.
We have only 30 seconds left, but is what we have at Ohio State here, the Billy Ireland, is it one of a kind or are there others?
It's one of a kind. We definitely have the largest collection of comics and cartoon art materials. There are other universities. Columbia University is starting to collect more widely in comics. San Diego State University. So there are some. There's going to be a new museum that will have a lot of comics material. It's the George Lucas Museum of Narrative Art in LA. So when that opens, I encourage folks to check that out. But what we have here really is rare. It really is very unique.
We have been talking with the head curator at the Ohio State Billy Ireland Cartoon Library and Museum, Jenny Robb. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much.
This has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.